to the Autoblog Podcast. I am Dan Roth, and I'm joined this evening by Stephen Ewing.
Hello, sirs.
And Zachary Bowman.
Gentlemen. Ooh, scholars.
And Dan.
I assume there are gentlemen listening.
Possibly scholars.
Possibly scholars.
None of those are anything that we are. Let's start with the garage. After I let everybody know, we are brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of all-season and high-performance summer tires and aftermarket wheels, suspension and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers, replacement lighting. No matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. Steven, you told me excitedly. Should I call you Steven, by the way, or is this that?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay.
Call me whatever you want.
When somebody calls me Daniel, I want to punch them. So
just don't call me maybe.
Oh, man. Speaking of how to punch things.
That was hilarious.
Clever. You're clever. My daughter has a really good joke, actually. How do you how do you wake up Lady Gaga? You poke her face. I was like,
That's funny.
All right.
I see what she did there.
Great. She's clever. Oh, she's seven.
No, you should
tell
totally
everyone heard. I know.
Yeah, you will too. And you'll pass it off as your own and be like, ha, ha, ha.
I will, actually. So hey, Steve, you guys.
What are you driving?
So I just spent a week with a very nice car that I hated a lot. I had the 2013 Lexus LS600H Hybrid, which, again, is a very nice car. There's nothing that it does particularly wrong or anything. It's, you know, it's big, it's comfortable, it's so quiet. It's just, it's a nice car. The problem is, it's $135,000.
Nope.
Ooh.
So, nope. Okay, so here's some things. Here's a couple
Jesus
things.
Christ.
I went and lined it up, and so, you know how Lexus makes the LS460, which has just the normal V8. The hybrid's got a V8. It's a 5-liter V8 with an electric motor attached, and it's 438 horsepower. It's a powerful car. I mean, it'll do 0 to 60 in 5.5 seconds, and it weighs, you know, 5,200 pounds, and it's all-wheel drive.
That is quick.
That is quick. That said, so you go to the Lexus configurator and you pick an LS460 long wheelbase, all-wheel drive, and you take every option and you get it to the exact same spec level of equipment that my car was, and it's $35,000 cheaper.
Yeah.
So you're probably asking yourself, well, I'm spending $35,000 extra. What do I get? Here's what you get. 0.4 seconds quicker to 60 miles an hour and 2 miles per gallon combined, assuming you're not driving it in sport mode.
That sounds like a win-win, Steve. I mean, that's almost a half a second quicker. And people have spent a lot more on horsepower to go that much quicker.
But Lexus buyers?
Yeah,
no,
exactly. Right. No one buying a Lexus LS goes, God, I really need that extra half a second to 60 miles an hour.
Yeah.
I will agree
and
with you
the
there.
People that buy Lexus hybrids are the ones that want the fuel economy. And if you drive the hybrid in sport or sport plus mode, you're not going to get it. I mean, I had it for the week, and I averaged 19 miles per gallon, which is one lower than the supposed EPA combined rating. But a 460 is 18 combined.
Oh, you got 19?
I got 19.
All right, I want everybody to remember that figure for later. But please,
19.
Continue.
Okay. So, you know, so let's not even talk about Lexus. So I went and I priced out a BMW 7 Series, a 750 Li xDrive. So more power, about the same amount of space, and I optioned it out with everything, even all like the weird M Sport stuff that you can get on the 7 Series.
Right, and I bet it came out to what, 115?
20,000 less than the LS600H, and gets better fuel economy.
And that's a decent driving huge car.
So, right, it actually drives well. This Lexus, so when they dropped it off, it was in comfort mode, which I just didn't even think about. I got in the car.
Comfort mode is analogous to angry mode.
Comfort
it makes
mode
you angry.
You can't feel anything. You can't. You have no clue what's going on from behind the wheel because you can feel the steering wheel itself, but the moment that you move it, nothing. There's nothing. The car is just body rolling over itself. You have no idea where your wheels are. It's terrifying to drive quickly in comfort mode.
Novocaine mode is what it is.
Yeah,
it's kind of like a whole body experience of how when you go to the dentist and get a filling and you can't feel half your face
basically
for quite a while.
that's exactly it. So then I'm like, okay, I'm doing this wrong. So I put it over into, I think it's like Sport S Plus. It's like the sharpest sport mode that you, you know, can put the LS into. And in that mode, the engine's very responsive. It is very quick. There's a lot of power when you need it, but it still rolls like crazy. And the steering is still very bad and overboosted. And it's just, I mean, I was talking with John Neff about this because he had a LS recently. And it's like this car that is, you know, one of the highest priced in the segment drives more like a Hyundai Equis than it does an Audi A8.
Like, yeah, that's about right.
And that's good for Hyundai. Like, you know, woohoo, nice job on your first attempt at a luxury car. You made something comparable to a Lexus. But if you're Lexus and you're falling in line with Hyundai in the segment that you're supposed to, like, be the best at, it's just, well, it's so not good.
To be fair, Lexus and Audi are never really sort of going to compete head-to-head. I would say Lexus and Hyundai are more on par because they're going for the more luxury side of things. I don't think you would say that the LS is ever a performance luxury sedan like the A8. It's more like an S-Class, right?
Lexus will tell you that the hybrid is the performance sedan.
Yeah, but Lexus is full of crap. I mean, I have to say, though, like, to be fair, are there separate settings somewhere buried that will adjust the steering weight and the suspension? Because, you know, you get it in an Audi, right? And if it has Audi Drive Select, my goodness, you can spend a half an hour just trying to figure
it out. I doubt it. I doubt it. And I understand that the people that are buying a 7 Series or buying an A8 are not necessarily the ones that are cross-shopping a Lexus LS. But the point is, if you're going to command so much more money over these cars, you have to offer something. And it doesn't offer anything. I mean, an A8 has a much nicer interior, better technology. The 7 Series is a much better to drive car. I don't get it. Like, I don't know who buys this car. Like, I can't even fathom, even in the Lexus world, of who's buying the hybrid LS.
Yeah, I think if I had...
I imagine not many people.
No.
How many of these are they selling? Like, two?
I don't know. I have never seen one that wasn't a press car.
Yeah.
Ever.
You think that... Because things like the Equus and the Genesis and the, you know, the larger luxury cars for some fleets, they're actually... You know, stuff that they buy.
Sure.
I wonder if I see fleet
Genesis, but no one is doing a fleet LS hybrid
at $120,000.
Right, because exactly. It starts at $120,000. So even then, that's absurd.
You know what I would buy if I had $120,000?
So many other things.
Everything
I would
else.
Put a down payment on a palace of a house.
Yeah.
Because that's way smarter.
Yeah. Right?
It's just. It's one of those times where I wanted to like this car. And again, there are things that are good. It's very,
okay,
very
cool. So yeah, tell us what's good about it.
You know, there was one point where I had to go pick up my brother from the airport and come back. And I just had to do it very quickly, just go get him, come home. And it's just the highway, the whole way to the airport and back. And for like someone who just got off of an airplane, my brother gets into the Lexus and just goes, oh, this is nice. And we just drive back to my house. You know, not feeling anything, being able to have a conversation quietly. It's a nice, you know, I have to drive across the state and not do anything except change lanes. It's great for that. Totally nice. Totally nice. It's got an awesome sound system. The Mark Levinson system, I think, is really good.
Yeah, the when I had an LS460L, the long wheelbase, a few years ago now, but it had the Mark Levinson system, and that's one of the few car audio systems. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, it's really, really good. The tech, there's a lot of really good tech. The problem is it's all operated through that stupid, like, mouse setup thing.
You don't like the mouse thing? I think the mouse thing's fine. It's serviceable.
I hate that so much. I hate that because... You look at this car and it's got this big 12-inch screen that's recessed sort of in the dash. If they would have just pulled it forward and made it touchscreen, boom. Why not?
You know what I love about the mouse thing? It's not touch capacitive. And it's not. And honestly, I think it's better than a touchscreen. I think touchscreens are kind of distracting, honestly. Like the little mouse thing gives you a little.
The mouse thing is kind
feedback.
Of distracting because you're constantly having to look where your cursor is.
I think
you
they're
can't
two
reach
two,
for the button and push it.
They're two different levels of distraction because with a touchscreen, you're like, you got to reach for the button and push it, and then make sure it got pushed. Make sure you didn't push the wrong button. Like, I don't know. I think the jury's still out on that stuff, but the haptic feedback you get from the little mouse thing isn't bad. I mean, honestly, knobs, dials,
right.
buttons,
right.
those are so much better than any kind of technological solution I have seen yet.
Which the LS actually has quite a bit of, and I like that. The fact that I can turn the volume up by turning, you know, a dial. And when I want to put on the iPod and not the radio, I can just press the button that says media, and it's there. It's nice.
So, in the interior, like you said, it's quiet. I'm sure that this one being $135,000, which is the price of an exceptionally nice double-wide in a very nice neighborhood, it has the very soft, the semi-aniline leather and yep. all of that. It's got a nice interior in it, right?
It has a very nice interior. It's incredibly comfortable. You know, it's – I mean, there's that whole phrase, Lexus quiet, Zach.
Yeah, baby.
It exists for a reason. I mean, this thing, it's like a bank vault going down the road. You can't hear anything. It's really nice, and you can turn up the sound system. It's a very nice cruising car. It's really good. The seats are actually despite the fact that I didn't really get a good driving position, I felt like I was still sitting way too high up, and then the steering wheel was at this weird tilt the entire time. It's very nice just to cruise down the highway with. That's all this car is good for. But so is everything else in the class.
Yeah, I don't think an S-Class would suck, quite honestly.
No.
I bet an S-Class. See, the last time I drove an LS, it does what a lot of Toyotas do, where it doesn't really lock on to straight ahead like the European cars, right? So it was like a Camry in that respect, where you just have to constantly just keep making these tiny little adjustments to the wheel, and it bugs me to no end. It's like, would you just settle down and go friggin' straight, please?
I don't really remember that, honestly.
And the Germans are like locked and loaded. They're just like, if you let your hands off the wheel on one end of Route 90 and just keep going, you'll wind up in Seattle. They're that good. Let alone the fact that Route 90 takes a big dip, but whatever.
Right, right. So long and short of it is I'm glad I drove it. I will be publishing a quick spin about it in the next. Couple of days for everyone to read, and I'm so glad that it's gone and I have a BMW M5 in its place.
Manual nice. M5?
DCT M5.
That'd be right.
I actually chose the DCT over the manual because everyone I've talked to says that it's the better car.
Oh wait, what is this choosing your car business?
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with that.
When they I'm scheduling M5s and they go, okay, we have a manual and we have a DCT. Pick.
Were you scheduling M5s for me or just for yourself?
For myself.
Okay. Just check. It's good to be the king. All right. So, Zach.
Mm-hmm.
Anything?
I had the LS460.
really?
So, you know, it's funny. Steve was just berating the hybrid for that whole half a second quicker. And I will say the base LS 460 feels slow-ish.
Hmm.
I mean,
is it
not
slowish because it's refined, or is it slowish because it's slowish?
No, I think it's slowish because it's refined. It just, you know, it doesn't feel like it does anything quickly. And I think the price tag, you know, I thought this was ludicrous until, you know, Steven, you know, whipped out his $78,665.
That is a lot of money for a car that's not really all that. It's just not anything to get passionate about.
Exactly. I've got to wonder, like, if I assume that the Lexus is for people who aren't necessarily passionate about cars, and if that's true, are people who are not passionate about cars spending money like this on these cars?
Yes.
So Zach, I'm sorry. One more time. What did you say the price was on yours?
$78,665 with destination.
Okay, so $56,000 less than the one I had.
That's a lot of money. And I got 20.5, by the way.
You got better fuel economy in the 460 than I did in the hybrid.
All right, but the 460 is lighter and smaller.
Yeah, was it the long wheelbase, all-wheel drive, any of that?
No, just the rear-wheel drive. Rear-wheel drive, regular wheelbase.
Oh, here's cool. The other thing, Steve. Zach's car had a bigger trunk.
True.
It did.
And it also had the banging sound system. We were
The trunk and the hybrid actually is really small. I took a couple friends to the airport over the weekend in it, and they struggled
That's all
to
you
fit.
Did. You operated livery service.
Yeah, I was about to say, are you moonlighting as a livery driver? Is that what's going
on? No, but I feel like whenever I have a car like this, I'm like, who needs to go to the airport? Because I want people to sit in the back and, you know, have that whole experience. But putting two large suitcases in the back of the hybrid didn't work.
Interesting. So you have to leave somebody behind.
No, we just had to use some of the rear seat leg room because there's a ton of that.
Sure. That's absolutely true.
So, all right. It had the banging sound system. Here's another question I have is, what did you guys listen to on the banging sound system?
Father John Misty, because that's why the podcast is late, everybody. It's totally my fault because I went to see a concert instead of hanging out with you guys.
It's not entirely your fault because I fell asleep at 8 o'clock last night with my 5-year-old and didn't wake up till 10. And when I woke up, I went back to sleep. So.
But the concert was awesome, and if anybody gets a chance to go see Father John Misty, you totally should, because it was rocking. Very good.
And Steve, I'm assuming you had, like, Social Distortion's greatest hits?
No, not quite. what was I listening to this week? A lot of, like, 80s stuff, really.
All right, we can stop there.
Okay. Such a music snob, Dan. You know that?
No, you know what it is I lived through the 80s, and I'm not fond of the 80s.
I like the music from that generation.
Just because you had a bad college experience.
I was not in college in the 80s, dude. Really?
It was totally intentional. What about you? What are you driving?
Today they dropped off, because we're a day late, they dropped off a Honda Civic. Got to say, not impressed with that one. We'll see what a week does with it, and we'll circle back on that.
The last week.
Last week I had a Dodge Dart Limited with like every option in it except for a sunroof.
What'd you think?
I really like the Dart.
See, it's a good little car. Everybody thinks
I like the Dart.
I liked it. It was funny because I went to a auto press association thing up here, which is where I got the interview that we'll have later with Mike Manley. But I was talking with Pierre. Now Pierre is this guy. I don't know if he works for GM, but he delivers GM cars around, and so. I know Pierre I've known him for a while now, so we chat, and he's like, oh, what are you driving? I'm like, yeah, driving a Dart, and so we start talking about how it compares to the Cruze and the Focus, and how all of a sudden that segment is very competitive, and the domestic nameplates all have good cars, and you know, so I'm like, oh, yeah, the Dart, I like the Dart, and he starts laughing. He's like, you like those 70s seats? I was like, yeah, I do, actually. I love them. They're super comfy. They're like Italian comfort, and Pierre is French, so I was like, you're a European. You should know all about that, and so that's my story. It's not as funny now, but it was funny then.
And then you found $20. That's how that goes.
The Dart, it drives really nice. It's quite disciplined, actually. The steering is maybe a little bit heavy, but I was surprised it actually like loads up in corners like you might expect it to in a car that's designed to go around corners. And the week before, I had the Sonata, which
didn't like
cornering at all. So the Dart was like a freaking sports car comparatively.
Did you have the 140?
No, I had the non-turbo motor, which feels a little gutless because it is. But on the other hand, it sounds great when you wind the snot out of it. So I did.
And the 140 sounds great all the time.
Yeah, it does.
I have to say though, like they don't have much of an exhaust on even the non-turbo engine.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. It's actually a small car that has some personality, mm-hmm. which is more than I can say for pretty much everything else in the segment.
It does, and yeah. I think that's what I like about it. It has charm, you know. It's not perfect. It's not as solid as a Focus. Probably not as solid as a Cruze either. It's been a long time since I've been in a Cruze, but it's still really comfortable. It drives really well. Visibility is good. Has lots of features for the price. I mean, this was a $25,000 car loaded up like it was. But, I mean, who pays retail anyway? So,
not Dan Roth, I'll tell you that much.
Just saying. I don't have really anything bad to say about it other than I could see it... In terms of reliability and like long-term stuff, there might be some rattles and stuff that show up because you look around the interior and you're like, yeah, okay, there's some cheapness, but nowhere near as cheap feeling as say the Civic that just showed up.
Which trim Civic do you have?
I think it's an EX. Mm. This is really
the only Civic worth that I don't want to say worth considering. The only Civic that I would really consider would be the Si.
Totally.
And even then, there's some stuff about that car that just kind of drives me up the wall.
One thing I noticed with the Dart, and maybe you guys have noticed this too, is like, how big are these cars in this segment now?
They're freaking huge.
They're huge.
Massive. Yeah.
You've been in an Elantra lately. You've been in a Cruze, right?
Like, yeah.
They're big cars.
A Cruze is the size of like a 91 Accord, easily.
It actually, like, when you get these things, even like the mid to late 90s Camry, you see them beside these C-segment cars, or the, you know, on the road, and you're just like, they tower over them. They're huge.
That's why when I hear automakers say, oh, it's so hard to, you know, get the better fuel economy, it's just really hard. I'm like, how about you build smaller freaking cars? There's a notion, right? That just seems logical to me. A smaller, lighter car, that's just a thought. I'm no engineer, but... putting that out there.
Yeah, I don't think they'd mind building those smaller, lighter cars. I think people would mind buying them.
Yeah, well.
They just don't. I mean, how many Fiestas do they sell?
Well, that's because there's the Focus that's just as cheap and
better.
Better in so every conceivable category. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm charmed by the Dart. I like Dodge's tech. I mean, it's got an 8.4 inch screen in it. It's all easy to use. It's a nice rig. I like it. You'd have no shame buying it. It looks sharp. It drives well. It's roomy. It's got all these little features like the stash. You can stash stuff in that passenger seat thing that folds forward, and it's got a very large trunk for its size.
Booze.
Yeah.
Booze and drugs and porn.
Booze and drugs.
What that stash is for.
Is that what you stash in your car, Zach?
No.
Okay.
No, I stash tools in my car, Dan.
That's what I stash in mine, but only in the press cars.
Yeah.
In my car, the tool is behind the wheel.
Did yours have the fancy gauge cluster?
With the screen in the middle?
Yeah.
Yes.
And what did you think?
I thought some of the information on that was like redundant. Like, it didn't seem as flexible as I wanted it to. Like, see, they make these gauge clusters and they're like, oh, it's great, but you can't get the exact display you want, right? Like, I can't see.
This is a display with like 70 customizable options, and Dan can't get a display he wants.
This is fantastic. Show me this.
Where's my Matlock?
You know, you too.
You know Dan's never happy. Come on.
Why can't I get the trip odometer and the fuel economy with the average fuel economy all in one cluster, all in one display on that? I had to flip back and forth, and I can't do it in my Jeep either.
Sure.
Bugs me.
I see.
That's the information I want. I want to see my average fuel economy, and I want to see the trip odometer.
All right.
That is all.
Are you listening, Chrysler?
And I want a knob on the steering column so I can adjust the ignition advance, so when I go to turn the crank to start it, I don't break my arm.
You would prefer if you had to manually pump the fuel pump as well. That would be stellar.
You know, a friend of mine in high school, he had a Valiant, and that did not have an electric washer pump. It had like a little rubber bubble on the floor that you press with your foot, and it just like squeezed it up. I was amused by that. So yeah, manual, but you never had a broken motor in that.
Yeah. It's just never used it either.
Yeah, you possibly also had a frozen rubber bag of washer fluid at your foot in the winter.
Wrong.
Yeah. So I mean, I think honestly, the Dart is a really good car and a really good class. It's got a lot of competition, but it makes a compelling case for itself. You know, they have tech that nobody else has, and I think tech is partially what sells cars in these segments. You know, it was really easy.
It's usable tech.
Yeah,
you know, it's not over the top. Like, the Uconnect system works. The nav is a little slow.
I think the most beautiful thing about the Uconnect system is that it's just so the response times are really quick. You touch something and it does it right away.
Immediately, yeah.
That's the best part about that system.
Yeah, and it's actually, you know, they've added some depth to it that wasn't there in the past because they've gotten out a larger screen. But, you know, the icons for all the stuff stay at the bottom. So it ends up, it's not as confusing as some other systems. And it's a little bit limited from what other systems do, but I think that helps it out. And I'm not a Luddite. I am not opposed to tech. I just want it to work. and the Uconnect stuff does, where like I got in this Honda today and I tried to pair my phone with it. Brand new Honda. I felt like I was legitimately trying to launch a rocket to the moon with a TI-83.
To be fair, there is just a TI-83 in the dash. Like, just the calculator.
That's all it is.
Honda's infotainment system, probably one of the worst on the market right now.
Okay, but
here's really
the thing,
bad.
Like,
it's a step up from the days of having to turn the calculator over to see the word boobs.
It's true.
But,
no,
but
there,
not much.
There are 5 pixels on the screen. Mm-hmm. It's really miserable.
And
really,
then, like, really. The Accord has 3 friggin' screens, right? It's got the little screen for the radio that you can't dim enough. It's got the bigger screen in the dash that you can't dim enough. And then it's got the screen in the middle of the gauge cluster.
Yeah, I love
There's
it all.
3 screens in the car, and none of them are useful.
Each screen has its own individual dimming factor. So,
yeah.
Which drives me up the freaking wall. I don't. Why are they not all controlled by the dimmer switch? I don't know. Probably because no one's ever used these cars before they leave Honda. I assume that's the only reason.
Honda is very well known as like an engineering driven company, and clearly the engineers are just like, oh well, dude, customers don't get it, they're doing it wrong, because that's an engineer's answer. It's like, no, you're not doing it right, you have to flip the switch. And
that's a German engineer's answer. The Japanese engineers used to be like, well, yeah, no, that's a German engineer's answer. The Japanese engineers used to be like, well, yes, but obviously it's wrong, so we're going to fix it. And I think that's just seems to have stopped at Honda.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I don't know. And I want so badly to like, I mean, I fundamentally like the thing, but it just like trying to operate it. And I'm just like, what year is this? This is so frustrating.
So
I don't know. I'm kind of interested. I want to drive the 2013 Civic at some point. I spent a very small amount of time in the 2012 hybrid, which was one of the worst cars ever.
You know what? So, take away the hybrid, it's still, I mean, they've made updates, I guess, but
right.
I just kind of like okay. Picture what a modern day Oldsmobile Alero would be. There you go.
John Neff's dream car.
Mm-hmm. Seriously, it's not that attractive, but it's not ugly. It's not that well appointed, but it's not stripped. It's just, and the design is weird inside, which Oldsmobile had down. Or like, okay, it's a Saturn. They're doing pretty good on making the Saturn. I don't know. Just, I weep for you, Honda. I weep for you.
True.
They'll get there. Yep. So we should talk about more exciting stuff.
The other thing that I drove this week.
Yeah, what was the other thing you drove this week?
For the 2014 Silverado.
And, yes, how was the 2014 Silverado, Zach? Tell us. Like us.
It was, well, Dan, I assume you read my fantastic review.
I did, actually. And you know, okay, I have some questions for you.
All right, well, fire away.
First things first. Mm-hmm. We'll start with the superficial because I'm that kind of guy. It doesn't look tremendously different from the old one.
Okay. Not at first glance, but when you see them side by side, the differences are night and day. I mean, the old one, everybody says this one looks older than the previous generation, but I don't think that's true. The other one looks just kind of just like dopey and maybe a little pokey is what I said in the review.
I don't know. I'm in that camp. Every time I see the front end of the Silverado, I shut my eyes. I think it's
while you're driving, even. Like, God, there's one.
Oh God.
Well, you know, I think this is certainly hearkening back to the old square nose of the, you know, say pre-88 or pre-87, somewhere around there. And I think that's totally fine. It's more tolerable with the Z71 trim because it sort of blacks out the grille. High country trim. Anything like that, and it's just, it's a lot of chrome. GM's always...
Merca.
Yeah, but even on the Z71, that's the, you know, the one that you drove and photographed for the review, obviously. It's the chrome on the bumper, and then it's those, they just look like they said, oh crap, we forgot to put fog lights on it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Just threw those in there. It's just... Ugh.
Well, all right.
It's a lot
of
bumper.
But here's the thing. So what you're saying is, like, when you compare it next to the old one, you can clearly see the differences, but people aren't going to do that. I mean, and it's hard to perceive something that doesn't look very new as all new. I mean, do you think that's going to hurt it?
Well, I mean, Ram did the exact same thing, right? I mean, they kept the identical exterior styling and put basically an all-new truck underneath it, driveline tech and the rest of it. I don't think it's going to be that big a deal. I mean, this is one of those segments where the GM, Chrysler, Ford would have to screw up really, really, really bad to start shoveling drivers away, buyers away.
That is a thing they are all capable of.
That is a thing they are all capable of. This is not that screw up. You know, it's a logical step in the right direction. Yeah, there are things about it that sort of irritate me. The engines are fine. The 5.3 that I drove had just stupid amounts of power. Feels good. Drives well. Supposedly gets decent fuel economy. We really didn't have enough time with the truck to really, you know, test fuel economy. Tows well. You know, they say you can have up to, I think it's 11,500 pound tow rating. That's not true. That may be true in like Kansas, but you know, I got to tow around a skid steer and a big heavy trailer, which is about 8,600 pounds, and the truck was working. I mean, the truck was seriously working, and that's true of all the trucks. You know, they stick these freaking numbers on there, and yeah, the truck is technically capable of doing it, but man, you are abusing the crap out of the driveline. You just are. Interior is incredibly quiet. I mean, really, really shut. You know, maybe. I mean, it's shocking. You know, it's partly due to a much stiffer frame and cab. Partly due to the fact they now have you know, the inset doors with better seals and acoustic glass and all the rest of that. It's amazing. You know, they had the previous generation there. Driving that thing on the road felt like driving something out of 1973 in comparison. I mean, it's a truck.
It's funny you say that. I feel the exact same way in that. So back in November, I actually got to go out to the GM Proving Grounds in Milford, where they let us drive early prototypes of the new trucks. We just weren't allowed to talk about them. And they had the current models there to drive alongside it. And you're right. It's like getting in the new one is like, oh, this is new, you know?
Yeah. You know, I think if
so
dealers
are much nicer,
if dealers really want to move these things, they will first put someone in a previous generation and then put them in the new generation, because the change, it's unreal. You know, you get in the new one and you're like, okay, yeah, no, this dash is nice. And you know, everything's kind of laid out nice, and yeah, it's kind of quiet and, you know, it feels good. And then you get in the old one, and you're like, holy hell, I cannot believe they were selling this truck in 2013.
Yeah.
And it's freakish. I mean, for a vehicle, if you want a vehicle that you can get in and tow something from here to California and back, you know, this is the one. You know, it's just super quiet. I think the Ram probably rides a little bit better with its fancy air ride suspension. I would have some reservations about longevity there. Just because I'm paranoid that way.
And they're not the only ones doing air ride.
No, but they're the only ones doing it on the 1500 at this price point. So, you know, something to chew on.
You, with your Lincoln experience, you know all about air ride as it ages.
Brother, my Lincoln rode on massive coils.
Alrighty. Because you always see those, like, 90s Continentals all jacked up or dragging ass. And
mine was a 71, buddy. Yeah. Nothing but all-American steel in there. I think it's a proper step in the right direction. I wanted it to be just a massive, you know, kicking in the saloon door, haha, we're the best truck out there. And I don't think that's this truck. You know, I think they're more ahead of where the previous generation was. I think that anybody who goes to look at a Ram, still, you know, you're perfectly in your right mind to walk away with that truck instead of this truck. I don't know. It's certainly a step in the right direction. It's not mind blowing, you know.
You seem really excited by this truck.
I'm not, you know. I don't know. It's fine. The interior is it's a step in the right direction.
You know, they are not going to quote you in this broadcast advertisement. You're like, the Chevy Cruze is Lexus Quiet, says Zach Bowman of Autobots.
Listen,
they're not going to be like, Chevy Silverado, it's fine.
It's fine. It's totally acceptable.
So which would you have? You're going out, you're buying a light duty truck. Which one do you buy?
Jesus Christ.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I buy a versus Ford versus Ram.
I'd buy used RAM 2500 with the turbo diesel and the 60.
No, you have to buy a new one. You have not be Zach Bowman for a minute.
You gotta gun to my head. Pull the trigger. All right, this truck was you know, it was loaded up, had lots of bits and baubles and all the rest. $50,000, and it's not even the classiest of the bunch. It's not the high country, big belt buckle model. It's a Z71 LTZ, so leather and Rancho shocks and some skid plates. $50,000. I don't know. I think the Ram is a really, really good truck. My personal experiences with the Ford line, can't say I'll ever put my money there again. Yeah, unfortunately, that's just the truth.
That's the laugh of Schadenfreude, my friend.
Yeah, thanks, Stan.
who was just poking me in the eye for two broken
balls? I don't know. I mean, I would... Jesus, I don't know. This is one of those segments where all of the offerings appear really nice on paper. They're all stupid expensive, and they all have their foibles. So it's just a matter of what you like, unfortunately. I do want to see the big V8 in this truck. I'm sure that would be, I'm sure that would help matters a bit. I mean, the 5.3
is... probably be a little fun.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about this while I was doing this drive. This is the last real place for an American V8. You know, the American V8 passenger car is effectively extinct. It's gone. Mm-hmm. So if you would just want to get in a vehicle and experience V8 torque and thrust, the pickup truck segment is your last place to do that. So
that's a damn shame.
It is a damn shame. It kind of breaks my heart. But still, kind of fun.
Yeah.
So there you go.
I think, honestly, I would pick the Ram just because... I have to say, I've been driving lots of Chrysler stuff lately, apparently, and I really think that they strike a very good balance. And we're talking like fully loaded press trucks here. So,
are you sure you're not just in like I bought a Chrysler Afterglow?
No. Right, I mean, part of the reason why I bought the Chrysler was because of the value in the. I mean, the Jeep was resale, and the way it drove was huge for me because. Honestly, the Fords have pretty good value, but didn't drive nearly as well. So, I think that they, in their models, they tend to have a pretty good blend. You know, they have consistent tech, which, you know, again, like you can get the Ram with the Uconnect setup, which is pretty freaking great. So,
yeah.
Oh, that's the other thing. It's the whole Chevy MyLink. You were talking about how Uconnect is really quick, like push the button and it reacts. MyLink does not do that.
No.
It's like MyStink.
Good freaking Christ, is it slow? It's like you push the button and you're like, did I push the button? Is it going? Oh, it's going. Okay, great. And then you push the button. You're like, oh, wait, is it? Oh, push the button again. Oh, now it's confused. Oh, fantastic. And then you're lost and the navigation isn't doing anything. So
excellent.
Fantastic, GM. Way to knock that one out of the park. Just going to put that out there.
So you ringing endorsement so far. And how is the 5.3? How does it compare to like the 5-liter?
5-liter feels quicker.
Ford 5-liter.
Ford 5-liter feels quicker. Feels considerably quicker. Feels, I don't want to say smoother. It just feels torquier, I guess. The 6-speed transmission in the Silverado is fine. It's the same 6-speed transmission that's been in that truck since forever ever.
Yeah, that needs to not be there.
Well, yes and no. I mean, they're making more power and they're getting 1 mile per gallon combined better than before. So whatever, you know, I think it's only a matter of time before an 8-speed shows up in the Silverado. They didn't feel the need to do it here. They put the money elsewhere. That's fine. I can understand that.
You know, it's not when you're going from 6 speeds to 8 speeds, it's definitely a difference, but is it really that big a deal?
It's not huge. No, but This is the old 6-speed, so it's not even. I mean, how much did they massage the transmission for the new truck?
It's not. I mean, it's the same gearbox as far as I know.
And yeah, it's not a bad gearbox. I mean, it's
totally fine. It's totally fine. It does its job. Job just fine. What I was really disappointed about, they really didn't necessarily try to save all that much weight. I mean, there are a few token, sacrifices to the gods of weight. There's an aluminum hood, which flutters at highway speeds. I think the frame is a little bit lighter, but you know, if I asked one of the engineers, you know, was weight one of your main concerns? Ford's been talking about doing an all aluminum bodied F-150 for the next generation. And they're like, yeah, I mean, not one of our major concerns. And the truck weighs basically what the previous generation weighed. This one was 5,300 pounds. So
that's not too bad. I mean, okay, so here's the thing. Impressively, like in terms of holding the line on weight, they also held the line on pricing.
Yep.
It sounds like it's a much better truck.
Vastly better truck, priced the exact same. So, you know, it's not... I don't want people to get the impression that it's a bad truck. It's not. It's so much better. If you bought a 2013, you should kick yourself up and down the road because this is...
Well, that's not necessarily true. If you got a screaming deal on a 2013, you can look at the new ones wistfully and go, meh, but I still have my money.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. It's just such a better vehicle. It's so much more civilized. So much more civilized. So... You know, it's fine. It's just not the light year jump that I was hoping it was going to be to put the Silverado so much farther ahead of Ford and Chrysler. What I'm almost positive is going to happen is the F-150 is going to roll out and they're going to dot this truck's eye. That's what's going to happen.
Possibly. I mean, trucks, I feel like we should move on from trucks soon. Okay. Because
sure. No, let's do it. Let's play. Rock and roll.
It's a hot segment, and I think we're going to see it heat up, especially as fuel economy regs tighten. We're going to see a lot more tech and a lot more innovation in the truck arena because they sell lots of them, so they need to get on that. But let's go to something way more exciting. Acura NSX.
Yeah, boy.
Built in Ohio. Now, I actually had a phone call from Mike Harley tonight who wanted to make sure that I understood the talking points here, and he interviewed the man with the golden ass.
I'm sorry,
his name is Ted. That is how he is known. It's Ted the engineering guy, and apparently this is the guy who is really good at tuning cars over at Honda and Acura, and he's been called in for like 20 years to help tuning Honda and Acura vehicles. Ted, apparently one of his first babies was the 93 Integra GSR. So
nice.
We'll just pause for a moment and sigh. And so because of this, Harley says that he went in very skeptical about the NSX and he's come away very positive. So what do you think about the idea of a hybrid supercar NSX? It's like breaks all the rules, right? It's an NSX, but it's a hybrid, and it's built in Ohio. Like all of a sudden, like right off the top, those are wrong.
You know, it gives me zero hope for this car. The fact that Honda is incapable of building a good hybrid.
There's that.
Name any good hybrid.
Well, hold on.
Aside from the first generation Insight.
No, I'm not. I'm not even going to talk about that. I can't say much about it, but I did a very short drive of a mule of the new hybrid RLX, the all-wheel drive hybrid, which is basically, as someone put it, driving the new NSX backwards. And that car is really good.
Okay.
You
can't talk about it.
No, we got like one lap around a track in it.
That really doesn't test the hybrid's ability to cope.
But I'm saying it was a very good driving car as a hybrid.
My point is Honda has done this to us over and over and over again. We're going to build a CRX. Awesome. Yes, a new CRX. It's going to be fantastic. Oh, it's going to be a hybrid. Okay, that's not really what I was hoping for. But, you know, if anybody can pull it off, Honda, it's going to be you. Oh, it's CRZ, huh? No, that is not what anyone wanted. Great.
It's not, okay. But the CRZ isn't a terrible car.
Yes, it is.
People give that car such a bad rap. It's not that bad.
You own a CRX SI.
I do.
You are out of your mind, Steve.
Which is the better car?
the CRX, of course. But
and how much better would the CRZ have been if they'd just put a K20 in it and been done?
Lots. It would
have changed everything.
That's right. So why make it more complicated? Why make it more expensive?
Why make it suck?
Why crap on that car?
In a vacuum, the CRZ isn't a bad car.
Fantastic. In a vacuum, I'm the most gorgeous man on the planet.
I was going to say, in a vacuum, everything is great.
I'm just saying, we've seen this happen over and over again. Honda had the HSV 010 a couple years ago. It was going to be a V10. It was going to be awesome. That got scrapped because of the recession, and now we get this hybrid thing made in Ohio.
Well, okay, but here's
crapping on my heart, Honda.
No,
stop
listen,
it.
Listen, you should be happy. Like, they could have kept the jobs in Japan. No, they brought them to Ohio. It's good. They built, a $70 million facility, the Performance Manufacturing Center. They're going to, hire or just move 100 jobs. They're going to move 100 people from their current operation. Like, all of that is awesome.
None of that has anything to do with the car. It's fantastic that we have jobs in Ohio. That's great. I that's no sarcasm. I really mean that. At the same time, has nothing to do with the car.
I'll say this with the NSX. I'm making a point of not getting very excited about it because then I can't be very let down if it does suck.
Yeah, but there's no way you can't get excited about it. The NSX.
I know.
You and I are on the same page. The NSX.
I am very excited about it, but it's good that I don't have to think about this car that often. It's not like a new Ferrari's coming out. It's, the NSX comes up every once in a while and you're like, oh yeah, that cool. We'll see it in 3 years.
To me, the NSX is more important than new Ferraris, than new Lamborghinis.
Have the original NSX to thank for how brilliant Ferraris and Lamborghinis are. And that's not my original point to make.
Dude,
that's Johnny
just,
Lieberman.
You're just setting yourself up for heartbreak here.
I do this all the time. I want Honda to be good.
I do too. I want Honda to be very good. But I've just sort of had to come to terms with the fact that most of what's coming out of there now just isn't. But
right.
Every once in a while, there is something that you're like, okay.
Well, I'm okay. The new Accord is like that mostly.
The new Accord is very good. I like the Accord a lot.
Who's to say that the new NSX is not going to be very good? I mean,
only the past 10 years of Honda experience.
Well, yeah, but
That's all.
Okay. Yeah, but they can't screw this one up. Like, they can't screw this one up.
There are things you can do when you're building a high-performance Halo car that you can't do when you're building a $25,000 hybrid midsize sedan.
There's also so much money riding on this car. They have to make it good. They can't. They cannot afford to screw this one up.
So I think we're going to be all pleasantly surprised. We are going to see it. We're going to see it in a couple of years. It's going to be probably out in 2015 in some form as a 2016 model. So we will see it. One of the other things that Ted apparently didn't necessarily confirm, but he didn't deny either, and this got Mike Harley very excited, was a couple of hints about the possibility of an S2000 follow-up.
What?
Yeah, I mean, it was basically like no definite no, but, that means that it could be a possible it's coming.
Well, it's funny because at every single auto show, and I know this because every time I'm running an auto show, someone that's there inevitably will ask me if we've seen it before, but they bring out that EVster, that little roadster concept. Even though it's old now, they bring it to every auto show still. And that's always sort of made me happy knowing that they're still kind of like bringing this thing with them.
That's like, look, here's our ugly little stepchild.
It's like we're still thinking about it. That's what it says to me. It's like, we're still thinking about it still.
Or they're just like, it's a ruse.
We're never going to build this.
But look, isn't it great? Look at what we can do. Look what we might do, but we never will.
What we could do if we cared, but we don't.
Yeah. So the flip side of that, though, is Lamborghini, right? And they just had their 50th anniversary dealy over in Rome, somewhere over there in Italy.
Santa Gata.
Yeah. Santa Gata Bolognese, right?
There you go.
Yeah. Now it's some pasta.
Yeah.
Bolognese sauce. All right. Anyway, the Egoista rolled out. I have my opinions.
What's yours? I bet you and I have the same opinion.
Perhaps. This thing is just tremendously ugly.
It's so bad.
Is it, though?
Tremendously ugly.
Please tell me you love this, just so I can picture in my head Dan Roth crammed in this little freaking Hot Wheel disaster about Boston.
No, I don't. I love the... I'm picking words carefully here. I love that it's a brash, bold, hideous thing from Lamborghini that's just out of its mind crazy. Because I think that's what we want from Lamborghini. I mean, really,
sure.
The Countach was named Countach because that was like, that's an expletive in Italian that's like, holy crap, because that's what people did when they saw that car.
Right.
So this is a Lamborghini. It's what you want. That's my opinion.
No.
I just can't get behind it. There's just so much going on
exactly. Everywhere.
There should have come a point where somebody walked into the design studio and just took away their pencils, right? And you're like, all right, everybody needs a break. Mm-hmm. Put down the espresso. It'll be fine. We'll come back tomorrow.
Well, like, they had the big brick of clay, and they were like, oh, I've got these knives here.
Everybody take a hatchet a side.
It looks like maybe they projected Fruit Ninja on the clay and just played that way.
It's just really...
No, I mean, all right. Well, to be fair, they named the car Egoista for a reason, right? It's like selfish, and they Walter De Silva, their stylist guy there, talks about its hedonism taken to the extreme. Certainly is. And what do rich hedonists do? They buy ugly crap. So this is, it's half of that anyway. It's ugly. I mean, it's got a V10 in the middle, and you know it's going to perform and that Lamborghini way, although I wonder.
It sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds great. I wonder if this is. We're never going to see this in production in any form, would be my guess.
Goodness, no.
But they'll probably sell this one for $3 million or something ludicrous.
A Ferrari kind of does that. Does Lamborghini.
Lamborghini does it all the time. They'll build these concepts, and then some filthy rich gentleman will buy them.
Mm hmm. Well, it's like the Veneno or whatever they pronounce it.
Why do they name their cars stupid things?
And they're gone.
That's because they're Italian, man.
The only three that will ever exist are gone already.
Yep.
All Lamborghini has to do is call a select couple of customers and say, hey, we're building a new car. That's the best part to say.
It's before the car is even unveiled. They're like, oh, yeah, it'll probably be about $6 million, and they're already all sold.
Right, because when the Veneno came out, they said, here it is. We're only making three. They're already sold.
Yep.
Like, those cars were sold before anyone saw it.
I think the sacrifice that they make you go through for this makes it all the more attractive, even though it's not aesthetically pretty in the classical sense. You know, like, it's very racy. Like, it's got a single seat cockpit. You have to do what race car drivers do. You got to pop off the steering wheel to get in and out. And it just... You know, it's nuts, and I like that. I like that.
And it's got a V10.
Courage. Yeah, and I do like
V10. Courage.
Yeah, well, I mean, what are they going to do? What do you want them to do? Make an Audi R8?
Something sexy?
Something that looks good? Maybe?
I think, you know, this is like, this is European fashion, right? And isn't that always weird?
Yeah, but this is... This isn't just weird.
Like the Veneno. The Veneno was weird and gorgeous, right? Like, I thought it was
kind of like
was
me.
Just,
No. Actually, not even anything remotely like you.
Wow.
No offense, Dan.
No, it's okay.
It's not the gorgeous part, it's the young part.
We didn't say anything about young.
That's what we just did. But the Veneno was you know, it was weird enough, you know, while still being very attractive, and that was appropriately Lamborghini. This looks like a Michael Bay reject. Is what this looks like.
Hmm. And you got to be pretty bad to be a Michael Bay reject.
I think this is that point taken. Mm. All right.
All right. I understand. So it's not your favorite thing.
No. However, the other Lamborghini on our list to talk about, I love dearly.
Wait, what? Uralis or whatever it is?
The Urus. I think it's hot as hell. I think it's hot as hell. I've seen this concept in the flesh a couple times. I think it's absolutely gorgeous. I think it makes sense for them to build just a foolishly powerful SUV. I like the idea of living in a world where this exists. So
So here's the thing about the Urus that is... Everybody's saying, well, we have to increase our market share. Even now, these niche supercar exotic brands. And so,
actually, what made me sort of happy about that is that Ferrari said, no, we don't.
Yeah, but then recently they made a wagon. So,
yeah,
with front wheel drive or four wheel drive. But anyway, is this Lamborghini moving down market to grab more sales? Which, I mean, when you're an automaker, that's cool. You go where the money is.
This thing's going to be between $150,000 and $200,000.
Right. Like, if you're Lamborghini and you're moving down market from where you currently sit, you're still way above the reach of most people.
Yeah. There's already stuff up there.
You know there are people who own the Cayenne Turbo who want something more exclusive, right? Where the Cayenne Turbo is not exclusive enough for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can get that.
And that's
those are the
be
people that buy the Cayenne Turbo S and they put the ridiculous, like, extra $10,000 wheels on it and they go that route, they'll buy this.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it makes total sense. And I think the design is really, really attractive. I think it's the appropriate meshing of SUV-ness and Lamborghini-ness.
SUV-ness. That's what they should call it. The SUV-ness.
If it were the 60s, I bet they would.
Yeah.
The all-new SUV-ness.
Yeah. No, I think it looks fantastic. And, yeah.
So, I mean, the backstory is, like, they haven't actually, like, announced this for production, really, have they? I mean, it's...
No, but the rumor is 2017.
Yeah.
Right?
Editorial director apparently said that, you know, Audi's head guy is like, yeah, Lamborghini has to do something, and they're going to do it at the mid-cycle refresh for all the vehicles that share, what is the MQB platform?
No, not MQB. It's, what is that called? Oh, no, it is the MQB.
The something platform.
The big MQB.
There's different, okay.
Because there's the little one in the Golf, and then there's the big one.
My general rule is to take anything that's more than, say, 3 years out with an appropriate size grain of salt.
Especially if it's, like, from a European-based car mag, because they seem to just like to, like, they take a dartboard approach with stuff.
What can we make up this month?
Like, eventually something's going to stick. But, I mean, does the world really need a Lamborghini for everyday use? That's what their guy Stephen Winkleman called it. Stephen Winkleman. We'll have Winkleman.
I mean,
I'm shunking it tonight with the names.
No, they don't. But
does the world
need any of the vehicles Lamborghini has ever made?
Yes, everybody needs more Miura.
True.
There's nothing wrong with that. So, all right. Well, it sounds like you guys are not real big fans of the Egoista, but you'd buy the Urus.
Zach,
yes, if it was just crapping $100 bills, absolutely. Why not?
All right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, before we move on, the Autoblog podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of all-season and high-performance tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. No matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. I did that for you. Wheels.
Wheels.
Wheels. So, all right. You've got a very special Project Ugly Horse update to share with us. But before we do that, we should listen to my conversation with Jeep CEO Mike Manley. I got to chat with him as we were handing him the 2013 official Winter Vehicle of New England award up here with the New England Motor Press. They are the first vehicle, I think, to win it 3 times in a row. So we had an opportunity to sit down with Mike Manley and talk Diesel Wrangler and Cherokee and some other good stuff. So we'll listen to that, and then we'll come back.
I'm Dan Roth with Autoblog Podcast, and we're here with Mike Manley, who is president and CEO of Jeep. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Fantastic. We were talking a little while ago about the Diesel Wrangler and how we will possibly eventually maybe see that in the U.S. market. Let's pick up that conversation. What kind of challenges are there bringing that vehicle to the U.S.?
Well, I mean, the very first thing is obviously being able to meet all of the emission standards that you have to meet whenever you use diesel technology. So making sure you can package all of the aftertreatment as well as the diesel powertrain in the vehicle is fundamental. I mean, without it, you're not going anywhere. I think the other challenges for us, really, when you think about Wrangler, is clearly a diesel powertrain, from a cost perspective, is more expensive than the gas variant. Wrangler today is sold out, completely sold out.
Good problem to have.
It's a good problem to have. One I'd like to progressively solve, to be honest, but it's completely sold out. But where I think for us, we are really going to be able to see the market reaction to diesel in Jeep is with the Grand Cherokee. So that will begin to hit the market in the really in the third, fourth quarter this year. If the market reaction is where I think it's going to be, then of course it will be... be a big boost to the considerations for us putting diesel in Wrangler.
And in terms of a Wrangler carrying a diesel powertrain, is that priced up around Rubicon? Is it above a Rubicon, or has that not been decided? My thought is, if it's a diesel in a Wrangler, it's going to take a vehicle that can get pricey and make it even more pricey. Not that people won't buy it and that people don't mm-hmm. want it, but is it going to price itself out of the market?
Well, if you think about, let's use the example of Grand Cherokee on pricing, because it's the only real example that we've got. The diesel powertrain is $2,300 more than the V8. Now, if you think about the fuel economy that you get and the residual value benefits that you get from a total cost of ownership, for many people that do mid to high mileage, that is a great package for them. So you're going to get two types of buyer. You're going to get the buyer that likes diesel technology, likes the way the vehicle drives, likes the capability it brings. Then you're going to get the other buyer that says, listen, I keep my vehicles for a long time, or I do a lot of mileage. So the total cost of ownership of a diesel powertrain makes a lot of sense for me. So I don't think that the step from the gas powertrain to the diesel powertrain needs necessarily to be too large to price it out of the marketplace, depending on what type of buyer you are. So, as I said, Grand Cherokee, $2,300 more than the V8, been accepted very well so far by the initial reaction to the market. As I said, we won't really see the true market response until it's in our showrooms. But you'd be looking at something of that order. So against a V6, that would typically be about $4,500 against a V6.
Money people spend anyway. When they buy a Wrangler, they end up modifying it, and you know, so that, yeah, there's a case.
We say that Wrangler is a, you know, for many people it's a canvas, right? They can,
sure.
It's built in a way that they can adapt it, modify it, and as we know, thousands and thousands of them do that every year.
So you seem pretty well versed in Jeep and what makes up the essence of the brand, but you came from Mercedes, from the Daimler side.
Yeah.
How difficult was that transition to make? Did you have a lot of learning to do when you landed at Jeep, or had it sort of just by osmosis, you go, oh, I love Jeeps, I'm happy to be here?
Well, you know, I'd been in and around Jeep for a long time, even though I was on the Daimler side. So in terms of the brand and what it stood for, I was very familiar with that. And frankly, you know, I love what the brand stands for outside of its products. Jeep has stood for freedom, it stood for personal expression, it stood for, you know, moving forward for a long, long time. All attributes that I think, you know, lie within everybody, frankly. So as a brand, I love what it stood for. I'd been around it, I'd driven Jeeps for many times, even in the UK, by the way, over 12 years ago I was driving Jeep. So the transition into Jeep, for sure that you go through a period where you're learning when you get on the inside, but it was shorter than you may expect, only because of that previous association.
Cherokee.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you expected the sort of split reaction of the Cherokee in New York. And I actually went and saw it, and I was impressed by it in person. Mm-hmm. Because it's one of those cars where you always hear the line, oh, the pictures don't do it justice. But it really is different in person than it mm-hmm. is in pictures.
Absolutely.
It's not the first time Jeep has sort of taken a shift with that particular model as well. I mean, remember we went from the XJ Cherokee to mm-hmm. the Liberty.
Absolutely.
Which was a big deal. But where do you see the reaction? Has that been exactly what you expected? And what's the, do you put on your brave face and say, you know what, it's going to be great among women, it's going to be great among the family buyers, and the hardcore Jeep people would never have bought it anyway, so we want to expand our brand and it's the perfect product?
Well, a couple of things. What we knew when we were designing Cherokee, outside of the fact that it needed to be a true Jeep with the capability that we've put in Trailhawk, that was fundamental. That had to be built into that vehicle because of the heritage of the name, the heritage of the brand, and everything else. But we knew that Liberty, for example, had been a very niche player in the marketplace, 3-4% of the biggest segment in the US. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the way that segment had developed, it really was a segment where a lot of what we would call import brands had done phenomenally well, attracted huge amount of buyers to their brands. So for us, what we wanted to do was to really put a design into the marketplace that could not only recognize some of what Jeep stands for in terms of our 7-soft grille, the trapezoidal wheel arches, all of those things, but really take progressed Jeep design into the next generation within the segment. And I think we did that. And I knew when we were doing that, that of course there are going to be a number of Jeep fans, Jeep customers, that would look at that vehicle initially and say, hang on a second, what have you guys done? And we got that reaction. And, you know, we have a lot of dialogue with our Jeep customers. One of the great things about the brand, the dialogue between us and our customers, I think, is probably more than most brands that are out sure. there. So we expected that reaction. But for me, having been around the vehicle for, you know, over 2 years it was in development, having seen people's reaction to it, when they get to see the vehicle, get in the vehicle, really look at the styling, I always see a dramatic shift from, you know, maybe looking at the two-dimensional photographs of the vehicle. And I think you mentioned it yourself. When you get to the vehicle, get to look at it and experience what it is in real life, a huge amount of people are saying, I really like it. I think it's going to resonate in the marketplace.
Well, I think it doesn't come across in pictures, the actual size of it. It's a mid-size SUV, and mm-hmm. it's more space efficient than the Liberty, which consumed the same amount of space, mm-hmm. but didn't offer the same amount of space inside.
So, absolutely.
You're going to have the 9-speed automatic, you're going to have the two engines, one of them the 3.2-liter Pentastar. So it's going to be far more efficient. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, as if I'm a family buyer, I look at that vehicle, and I would have certainly, had I had the opportunity to consider it buying, I would have certainly looked at it, because it does tick off the boxes.
Sure.
And you know, is expansion of the Jeep brand something that you have in mind, or are you happy at the amount of sales you're shifting at this point? You mentioned the Wrangler is sold out.
Mm.
The Jeep, the Grand Cherokee, is doing quite well.
Yep. Sold out as well.
You know, so how many more Jeep models do you need at that point, and how many more sales do you need, or is it?
Well, I think what we have to be, we're a pure SUV brand. So
we're never going to see a Jeep sedan. Never.
probably not in my tenure. Now, you know, you couldn't rule out a pickup, because that's been in our history as well. Mm-hmm. But we are actually an SUV brand, and I think because of that, we should be relevant in all of the SUV segments. The midsize is the biggest SUV segment in the world, so that's a no-brainer. So in terms of expanding the brand, for me, there's the emergent, really small, I would call it B SUV. Segment that, particularly in international markets, Europe, Asia, for example, is growing and growing very, very strongly. And then here in the US, an area where I think we should be relevant, have been relevant in the past, is a vehicle larger than Grand Cherokee, Grand Wagoneer size.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think about the way that the brand is going to develop in the near future, you will see Grand Wagoneer. Not in all global markets, certainly here in the US, Middle East, as I've said, and then you will see the addition of a smaller SUV that will really open Jeep up to those buyers that are now coming into the market at that end that we don't have access to because we start at compact. And that's how you're going to see us expand our brand. From a volume perspective, as you know, 2012, we hit just over 700,000 units, which was a world record for us. That was great. There is, in my mind, absolutely further growth. 2009, I said I'd like to sell 800,000 vehicles worldwide in 2014. I think with Cherokee on board, we will do significantly better than that number.
Fantastic. Well, and you've won the reason why you're here is that you've won the New England, the official Winter Car of New England award for the, is this the third year running?
Third year running, yes.
So congratulations on that. I know New England is a huge market for you.
It is, yeah.
And so hopefully we continue to see more Jeep product and more evolution from the brand. I'm curious to see how you take the cues from the Cherokee and use those on other products within the brand. Does that portend the future of Jeep styling? Because at a certain point, you know, you've got the Wrangler, which is retro.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the retro cues. You can't go too far with that. You get to a certain point, you're up against the wall. So are we going to see that trickle into other Jeep models? We're going to see more of that look.
Well, remember, and I think this is what you're referencing, we've always had the bookends of look. We've had the Wrangler more retro style. We've always had Grand Cherokee, which is a more sleek, sophisticated, premium style. So that's given us quite a wide canvas to play on in terms of our designers. So I wouldn't say that you can look at Cherokee and say that's the true full future direction for Jeep. I think when you see our small SUV come out, you will definitely know it's a Jeep immediately. You'll see that we've, again, there are certain cues that we've taken and we will continue to use. But when you see it, I can absolutely assure you're going to say that is a Jeep through and through.
And when are we going to see it?
Well, you get to see that vehicle 2014.
2014, we'll see the Compact and the Grand Wagoneer?
No, Grand Wagoneer will be out into 15.
15?
Yep, it'll be out into 15. But when you see the small one, as I said, you're going to look at it, and you'll have to give me a call and either confirm I'm right or I'm wrong, but I'm
certain.
You've
seen it, right? If it's 2014, it's pretty much done. It's ready to go.
It's, as we say, cooked.
All right, we'll follow up and we'll see what the opinion shakes out as.
But, great.
Well, a lot of future product to look forward to from Jeep, and I appreciate your time here with us today.
That's great. Thank you. Thanks for your time.
So that was Mike Manley. Lots of fun things to say about diesel Wranglers and when we can expect them. That's probably the most important thing on the top of your mind, I'm sure, Zach, is a diesel Wrangler.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing that would make me turn over the keys to the F-250 quicker than a diesel Wrangler. I mean that. Rubicon Wrangler? Ugh.
Well, I don't know about a diesel Rubicon Wrangler. I mean, I think that what they're doing is they're testing the market with the Grand Cherokee, because that's here, and they're going to see how well that gets taken up by buyers and maybe use that to help build their business case for the diesel Wrangler, which already exists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the packaging difficulties that he was talking about in terms of getting stuff like after treatment and all of that stuff built into the Wrangler with the 2.8 liter VM Motori diesel has been done. So I think now they want to see how it works out with the 3 liter in the Grand Cherokee, which they're not the same engine, which I wasn't aware of, but they're different, even though they're similar in size and they're from the same supplier. But I think it's going to either slot in between like Sahara and Rubicon to start.
So you don't think they will make a turbo diesel Rubicon?
No, I think they will, but I think that you'll be able to get the diesel without going Rubicon, although
mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's going to have a lot of torque. So you,
yes.
Yeah, so the Rubicon has the standard Dana 44 rear axle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or does the Sahara have Dana 44 rear?
They all have Dana 44 rears. The Sahara has 44 front and rear.
And so does the Rubicon.
I'm almost positive. The Rubicon is what I meant. Almost positive. Don't.
Yeah. I know. No, I know the Rubicon has. Yeah. All right. Well, we should do our homework before we yammer about that. But
totally should. Surprising me with axle questions.
Well, I figured if anybody knew about axles. So we've got a 3-man poll here, and they knew reaction with the Cherokee. It was very interesting to actually like. We were handing him the Executive of the Year award as well. They cleaned up this year, and. Our president of our group like actually took a shot at the Cherokee. He's like, yeah, they won it for the Grand Cherokee. It's great. Jury's still out on the Cherokee. And I was just like, you just sucked all the oxygen out of the room. Like, really? Have some class. But I did ask him about the Cherokee. You know, I was kind of just like, you had to know it was going to happen. And they did. They focus grouped it and stuff. And his answer was pretty spot on, I think, to what they expect to happen with it. I think that, I don't know, we may not like it, but I think that the people with money buying it are going to like it. And I kind of, actually, I saw it in New York. I kind of dig it.
I don't hate it as much as I did now that I keep seeing it all the time. But it's still really ugly.
Yeah, it's not.
I don't think it's going to grow on me like the Juke did. Because now, like, I think the Juke looks great. I love the Juke. But I don't know. Maybe.
It's the small headlights. Small headlights are what I think throw me
off.
It
is. I've said anything. This before. It's just that the Juke looks weird from every angle. But you look at the Cherokee from the back and it's like, oh, that's a Kia. That looks good.
Yeah, it looks like a Sorento.
You know? Like, and then but, you walk around to the front and you're like, oh, no.
No, it is not.
No, goodness.
I have it. It looks particularly badass in Trailhawk trim, though, with those, smaller fascias and stuff. I don't know. I think once we see more of them, the initial shock's going to wear off. I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, and it's not the first time Jeep has changed their style up either. I mean, do you remember when the first Liberty came out?
Yeah.
I still think that original Liberty is hideous.
Correct?
Yes. That's because it is.
I didn't know anybody was arguing this point. But
okay. Correct. All right. Well, the jury's out. I just want to drive it now and see how it drives and all of that stuff. So in the meantime, though, between now and then, you're working on Project Ugly Horse and you have news. Wait, tonight on a very special Autoblog podcast, Zach Bowman talks about Project Ugly Horse. Okay, we can go now.
Are you sure?
Anything yeah.
else you'd like to talk about before we get there?
No, did you like my announcer voice? Was it good?
No, it was very good. No, it was very good.
Okay, excellent.
So I figure I should probably let everybody in on the engine choice, and I wanted to
somebody on Twitter said, "I hope it's a diesel."
I thought about that actually. I thought about doing a 4BT.
That would be hilarious.
Just to be super weird. And I wanted to make the announcement first on the podcast because I think the podcast listeners were certainly instrumental in helping the project take off, and you know, saying that you wanted more of it on the site, and I guess you guys sort of gave the series legs, so I certainly appreciate that. So I guess we should go back to the LA Auto Show when Mr. Stephen Ewing ran into a representative of Ford Racing Performance Products, who had caught wind of the Ugly Horse project and just sort of offhand mentioned the possibility of providing an engine for the project. My original plan had been to yank the Boat Anchor 2.3 liter four-cylinder that was in the car and put in a turbocharged 2.3 liter four-cylinder from an 87, 88 T-Bird, somewhere around there. You know, 190 horsepower, you could get more than that with a little bit of poking and prodding. But the joy was I had the engine. It was cheap. It was easy. Everything bolted up. Well, Ford came to us with an alternative proposal.
That is neither cheap nor easy.
That is neither cheap nor easy of putting the EcoBoost 2-liter in the car. So they sent us the engine. And just, you know, a couple specs here. So the engine weighs 291 pounds, and it's in Focus ST trim, so 252 horsepower, 270 pound-feet of torque.
Okay, so that's both much lighter than the 2.3, right?
Yeah, it's 75 pounds lighter than the 2.3T, and that's an extra 62 horsepower over that engine. Yeah.
You'd have to do a little bit of work. I mean, the Ford 2.3, the old iron block
Eskimo motor,
it's pretty strong. You can get it to 260, but...
You can get it well over 300 horsepower with a little bit of time. So to give you to put it in a different perspective, so in 89, the GT, you know, no great shakes, came with the cast iron 302. The EcoBoost 2 liter is 255 pounds lighter than that engine, and puts out 27 more horsepower.
How much more torques?
It's very similar. I think the 302 puts out like two. I want to say it's like 280.
It was like 300, yeah.
280 somewhere around there. So it's very similar. One last fun spec. So the other alternative would have been Coyote, right? To do the modern V8, which is still a huge bane, but it can be done. A couple different guys have done it. The Coyote is 149 pounds heavier. But it also puts out 168 more horsepower.
Yeah, a whole lot more horsepower.
So, you know, that would have been the smart way to go. What I like about doing the EcoBoost, two things. Well, more than two things. Primarily, no one's done it before. If I can make this work, I'll be the first person on the planet to have an EcoBoost four-cylinder Mustang. Ford's already made it clear that an EcoBoost four-cylinder is coming to the 2015 Mustang. And I think it's kind of fun to have, you know, a forebearer to that lineage rock a similar driveline philosophy. I like the idea of taking as much weight out of the car as possible. By the time I'm done going with a different K-member and the rest, I'll have over 300 pounds off the nose of the car.
So you're going to have to figure out springs then, because it might be weird.
That's right. It's going to be very weird. So there are a number of sizable hurdles to getting this engine in the car. I'm sure most of you are thinking, well, the Focus ST is a transverse mount and the Mustang has a longitudinal mount. So how the hell is that going to work?
You have a welder, son.
Yeah, pretty much. Good question. I'm glad you asked. Not easily. Fortunately, there are some guys. My main saving grace here is the block is the same basically as the old Duratec four cylinder that they put in the Ranger. So there is some built in aftermarket support. There are bell housings that can be had that will help me mate to my current transmission.
You're going to use the T5.
I'm going to use the T5 and. I'm going to use the T5 for a couple different reasons. It's light, number one. It's stupid light. I think it's between 70 and 75 pounds. It's
also inexpensive.
It's super cheap. There are a million of them out there. They can be built to withstand decent power in stock form. They'll take up to 300-ish horsepower reliably, and I don't intend to be putting down any more than that. We have partnered with Maximum Motorsports. If you're into the Mustang business at all, I'm sure you know these guys. They are the people when it comes to making a Mustang handle. And they have been kind enough to share their wisdom when it comes to putting stupid engines in stupid cars. So they're definitely being help. But I know this is a different tack for the project, right? The initial plan was cheap, do as much of it as I could myself.
Hey, cheap is free. If somebody's going to give you a motor, you take it, dummy.
Right, sure. and, you know, I there's a slight pang of remorse in the idea of losing sight of just a dirt cheap, you know, beater race car. But the idea of building the world's first EcoBoost four-cylinder Mustang is a little more appetizing.
I think we should get Ford to actually take this car and use it, you know, in their road show when they present the actual EcoBoost Mustang. I think that would be cool.
It's going to be so scroungy. They're not going to want anywhere near it. Yeah. I mean, the install is going to be clean. Other challenges. Engine management. It's a direct injection engine. There are not a lot of engine management options out there for direct injection. Simply getting the engine to fit in the engine bay. The EcoBoost engine is probably 5-6 inches longer than the 2.3 because of the high-pressure fuel pump on the back and some cooling lines. So there may actually have to be some firewall trimming unless I want the engine hanging well out over the nose, which I don't. So the project just got more expensive, more time-consuming, and more complicated, but it's still going to be fun. And I hope you guys sort of deem it worthy of your time to keep following.
I think it just got entirely more awesome too, though. You know, like,
it's pretty cool.
Yeah,
it should be pretty rad. I'm
Stephen Ewing. We have you to thank.
Absolutely. So here's to Mr. Ewing.
I don't suck at my job all the time. is the
Nobody was implying that you suck at your job at all, except for you get M5s for yourself and I get civics.
Yeah, well, I get a civics soon.
Yeah, it's going to be like an SI.
It is.
Yeah. See?
Steven. SI sedan. SI sedan.
Oh. Either way.
It's kind of the one to have, really. Mm-hmm. The sedan.
Yeah, well, so if anybody has like a rebuilt Volvo transmission, I'm game. I'll put your sticker on the door.
I thought you were rebuilding the Volvo transmission.
Yeah, no, I'm replacing the valve body. I'm being lazy and like I got a kid in soccer, a kid in t-ball, day job, house. You know,
all I hear out of your mouth.
These
is...
are things. See, our excuses. I'm very good at making excuses when I'm not really that motivated to fix it, and I'm not motivated.
My lady unmentionables hurt. That's all I hear from you.
You know. There's other crap to fix, which I'm also avoiding. So I'm just, we'll let it pile up and I'll need it one day and it won't be there. And so I'll frantically borrow a car for a week and then fix it and something else will break. And then I'll just burn it to the ground.
Preaching the choir, preacher man.
Be done with that. That's my story. So we should actually hit up the Q&A a little bit.
Yeah.
We'll do this sort of lightning round style. I think that was good. The way we did it last week, although some of these sort of got a little drawn out. But let's start. Do you see Tesla becoming a major domestic automaker someday like GM or Ford?
No.
Years and years and years and years from now, maybe.
No.
What do you say no?
I don't know. Maybe you're right. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking so near term, that's why.
Yeah, I mean, you got to think that Ford and GM are massive global entities. I mean,
right,
huge.
See, you say down the road, and I'm like, oh, like 2018? No way.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking 50, 60 years from now. That's a possibility.
Well, I'll be dead, so who cares?
Yeah, cheers to that. Not you being dead, I just us being dead.
I mean, you can choose to both if you'd like. That's fine.
That came out a whole lot worse than I intended. Moving on, Dan. Next question.
Okay. Richard from Florida says he lives in Florida, where air conditioning is very important. When buying a new car, is there any way to compare air conditioners between cars?
You are my favorite, brother. buy a thermometer, I guess?
Well, okay, here's the thing. Like, automakers test these in giant, like, heat soak chambers and stuff, and they do keep metrics on how well the system, like, you'd be surprised how many requirements there are. Like, there's actually a requirement for how fast heat comes up and the defrosters start to clear the windshield and stuff in the winter, and there's all kinds of safety standards and everything. But I think probably the thing you want to do is maybe an AC shop would have one of those little clip-on thermometers you can put in the center vents. You want to put them in the center vents all the time and then put the AC on max non-recirculate and see how quickly it tears the temp down and how low it goes. That's about it. That's what you do when you service an AC system and then you test it. You say, okay, I should see this, you know, at least this temperature at the center vents at, you know, after this many minutes or whatever. So that's that.
Yep.
Hooray. Anything to add, Steve?
No.
Okay. Why does the biggest auto market in the world, the U.S., I don't think we are actually anymore. We're getting to second place soon. Why does the U.S. get the least variety from foreign manufacturers? Why can South Africa and Mexico get cars like the Scirocco and not us? It makes no sense to me, says Carmivore.
I'm going to say import and crash safety regulation.
Mm-hmm. I'm also going to say apathetic market.
That too.
We don't buy it, even though you'd like to. Most of your friends and colleagues don't care, and they drive Corollas.
A lot of it is crash pedestrian safety stuff.
Yeah, if they're not in the, if they should not be in the road when I'm
which I will say is not a horrible thing. I wrote a post today about how Brazil has a really, really terrible traffic death ratio. It's like it's when it's weighted for driving population, it's four times what we have in the U.S. And they've finally gotten an independent crash like traffic safety board now, sort of like our IHS, and they put the top four selling cars or four or five car best-selling cars through this crash test regimen like we have in the U.S. All four or five of them had one-star ratings.
What were these cars? They were stuff that we don't get in this market, and we have
correct, but they're by brands like GM and Fiat and those guys.
The big sort of because they were captive markets for a while in Brazil, so they had their own auto industry. I mean, that's the biggest. Brazil is the biggest country in the Southern Hemisphere.
It's the fourth largest auto market in the world.
Yeah, it's huge. So
wow,
yeah, Brazil's no joke. driving there is
terrifying.
Yes.
Just next year, automakers will be forced to have anti-lock brakes and airbags. So if you think that automakers really care about your safety, they don't. They care about making money.
Yeah, well, and the money is to be found in developing markets. That's why they're going whole hog into China, because none of those safety regs really... Oh, I mean, there are safety regs, but not like here.
Right.
Right. You know, it's a very loose market in that sense. So they can make a whole lot more profit. And that's what they're doing. So thank you, other people, for dying in cars that we can't buy.
Yes.
That was really callous, Dan.
That was callous. That was really callous. Callous? Really? What? Cynical.
Could not be paid to care about those dying people in South America.
I do care about them.
It's totally fine.
I think it's... It's horrendous, but here's the thing, right? Those people...
It's horrendous, but it's not me, so... No. I'm joking.
Those people... It's lifting their standard of life. I'm not saying that these are benevolent corporations.
By dying?
Okay, there's inertia, right? When you have a developing country, there's inertia for the country to develop into a first world nation. And they're getting there.
That's true.
All right. So that's all I'm saying. It will get better. And it's already getting better. And so we should move to a different question, like why no coverage of the tire rack for one lap of America? And I will say that's coming, maybe not on the podcast directly, but Mr. Pockert was there. And I think you're going to see, I think I'm correct on that, right, Steve? We're going to see coverage of that?
Correct.
I believe so.
Okay.
I don't see why we wouldn't.
Okay.
But, I don't know. We'll see. It should be coming very soon, I would imagine.
So there you go. Let's see, another question here. Given auto sales seem to be doing well right now among the cars you really like, which do you think will sell well and which do you think will not move off dealers' lots? Among the best-selling cars, which do you hate and don't understand why they sell?
Good God, that's a question.
I can understand. I can answer the second part a lot easier.
Right.
I hate boring cars. I don't know why any boring cars sell. I won't name names because we do enough of that. Man, there's a lot of cars I just don't understand why people buy.
No.
True.
No.
Cars that I like that I think will sell well.
Cars that you like that you think will sell.
Honda Accord is an obvious. The car's really good, and it's going to sell really well.
Yeah. Even with that terrible tech system.
The Silverado will sell really well. It's a pretty good truck.
Yeah. This is a thorny chestnut of a question.
There's so many angles. Good Lord.
Yeah.
Let's not go there. Tis a silly place. Let's move on.
Selling cars. Which do you hate?
Yeah.
I don't really hate any car on the road right now, to be perfectly honest.
I don't really hate either.
Even the Chrysler 200 is a tolerable car. Like, really, you look at, like, the early to mid-80s and all the really abysmal cars people were buying. We live in the freaking promised land of the automotive universe.
The only car that I, like, full-blown will defend to the day I die hate is the Smart.
Well, yeah, but everybody hates that.
Yeah, but everyone hates it, and it doesn't sell, so it's not...
Right.
I was actually talking admirably about the. I wasn't being admirable. I was.
Oh, Traverse.
You hate the Traverse.
That's they sell just a crap ton of those, and I cannot stand that vehicle. Cannot possibly be paid to stand that vehicle.
But, I mean, that's not. Okay. All right.
But I do understand why they sell. I understand why they sell because people are sheep, and they feel like they need three rows, which they don't. Dan. And do they?
The reverse would be handy occasionally, but generally people are buying insurance at that point. Like, exactly. Oh, well, we could be taking grandma to the hospital.
It's like the all-wheel drive thing. It could snow. It's like people buy all-wheel drive here.
Well,
in Knoxville.
Yeah, that's ridiculous in Knoxville. Right. I did just buy a four-wheel drive vehicle.
Right. It's because you live in Boston, where winter happens. Here, yes. we just get like mildly chillier rain. That's what we get.
We get all-wheel drive here, but...
Right, which makes sense.
Well, I mean, there is winter in Detroit. Like, that was the thing. Like, I've had offers to move to Detroit, and it's just like, no. No. Well, I'm not going to move from winter to more winter. Like,
right.
From like, somewhat healthy economy to that economy. Not going to do
Land's
that.
Cheap. You can buy, like, a whole city.
Yeah, sure, block. Land's cheap. That's great. That's... All right. Let's move on.
Let's not have this discussion.
Yeah. We're going to make Steve mad. Like, don't get me wrong. I respect the hell out of people who love Detroit and want to stay.
Let's just move on.
All right. Why do auto journalists complain when brands expand their model range to serve niche markets? I'm thinking of BMW and Mini in particular. Why is choice something to bemoan?
Well, smart choice is fine, right?
Right.
Like when I know people, you know, complain about, you know, the whole Porsche thing when Porsche started making sedans and SUVs. I think that's freaking brilliant and
that's
awesome.
Because, I've been arguing with someone about this. The reason, you know, the Porsche makes the Cayenne and the Panamera, and now there's the Macan or Macan or whatever. They do that so we can have like 20 different versions of the 911, which is awesome.
Yeah, it's not like those machines necessarily dilute the brand. What we have issues with is when BMW starts bastardizing a naming structure that's been in place and functional since the 80s and starts cranking out these weird hatchback long roof things that don't really serve a purpose. They're no more functional. They don't drive any better than any of the current models. And the same thing with Mini.
Right.
Why do we have the Mini Coupe? Why is that? Why is that here?
Because backwards hat styling, Zach.
Or it's, you know, the better question is, if we're going to have the Mini Coupe and then we're going to have the Mini Roadster, why do we still have the Mini Convertible?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Who uses those back seats? No one.
I think I put a...
No one with legs.
I bought a Cozy Coupe the last time I had a Mini Convertible, and it wouldn't fit in the trunk or anything. I had to put the top down and just jam it in the back seat.
Terribly.
Yeah.
Still, it's not that we're, you know, we're saying, oh, we don't want all this choice. It's like you're going to spend all this money to create this weird thing in your lineup that you don't need. And
ultimately no one will buy.
Right. Or as we've seen with, you know, the 5 Series Gran Turismo, BMW does that. They're super proud of it. They launch it in the States. And then several years later, they're like, oh, crap, maybe we should have just given them the wagon.
Right.
Because no one's buying the 5 GT.
Yep.
Well, it's also expensive and ugly.
Mm-hmm.
There's that. Like, if you're going to do something, make it interesting or perform it. Like, the Panamera, right? It sells better than any other Porsche, I believe. And it's not exactly...
The Cayenne is still the best-selling.
Is it? Okay. They sell a hell of a lot of Panameras, though. And
oh, yeah.
They're not exactly attractive, but they're super functional. They perform really well. Like, they do things that they're really not supposed to do, given this, like, you look at the specs and you're like, huh, that's weird. It seems like these acceleration numbers are from a completely different car, mm-hmm. given what I'm reading about the powertrain. But, you know, that's a very unique vehicle. It's not like, well, we could have given you the wagon, but we gave you this ugly thing instead that's not even as good as the wagon. But here it is. Suck it, America. I don't know.
Amen.
All right, so $30,000 used E62 M5. Terrible idea or horrible idea?
I'm sorry, one more time?
$30,000 used E62 M5. Terrible or horrible idea?
Best idea. Probably the best idea you've had. Yeah, no, it's really the best.
E62?
It's fine. Yeah. M5, Dad, what are you worried about?
Well, it depends on which transmission... Right, that's the one that had SMG. I drove an E62 with SMG. It sucked. The V10 was awesome. The transmission, not awesome.
No, it wasn't that good.
Yeah.
$30,000? What else are you going to buy for $30,000? Nothing that has a V10. Just saying.
I bet you could buy a Ford F-250.
How did I know Dan Roth was going to say that? How did I know?
Come on, man. You set it up, I knock it down.
It's good. It's good.
You open the door for that one, and you open the door. Okay.
It's fine. It's fine.
All right. Well, let's hit up an email question, because there's this guy. This guy likes to just like write in every now and then and poke his thumb in my eye every now and then. Tom Mannion, you know who you are. And so he writes
we
in.
We all know who he is.
Yeah.
Now.
He writes in, this is Tom, the guy who blew up his engine after following Dan's oil change advice. Now, that's his first sentence. Tom, I'm going to stop you. I went back into my Gmail, and here's what you wrote, Tom, when you blew up your engine. I extrapolated on Dan's advice, oil change suggestions below, and just changed the oil myself. We had talked offline. We had some chats. I changed the oil myself using Mobil 1 synthetic, skipping a mechanic. Bad move. $3,000 and a replacement engine later, I will no longer be changing my own oil. Okay, do you know the reason why? It had nothing to do with my advice. And here's the reason why. Apparently, I didn't look to see if the gasket from the old filter was still attached to the oil pan, and that was likely the cause of the new oil filter spinning itself off, eventually leaving me with a seized engine the week I started with a new job. Tom, I feel bad for you because that sucks. But I also want to say two things. Now you know how to do an oil change and not blow up your engine, so I wouldn't shy away from it. Also, there's a bright red light on the dashboard that lights up when oil pressure goes away, and if you notice it, which you should, you can shut down the engine and avoid blowing it up. They can run.
Well, I mean, also I'm you know, I do my own service all the time, and I'm hugely paranoid about after I've done work, right?
No, I get it.
Every time the vehicle pulls in, I'm checking for leaks and that sort of thing. And I know that's one of those things that just comes from experience. As my father says, you know, sometimes you have to stand back and let the scars of learning happen. And brother, you've got a $3,000 scar. So,
but I like how he writes it and he opens his. He's asking for advice here because we haven't even gotten to his latest email. It's
just, well, yeah, I remember this. I remember when this happened, when you detonated his engine. So.
Thanks. Look, I feel bad for the guy. If it's any consolation, I blew up a transmission on my own. It was fun. Really, really fun. And
he still has this one, so.
No. He says, I'm in the market for a new car. His first-gen XB, which was the one that blew up the engine, is still running strong. He wants to replace his fiancé's 245,000-mile 98 Acura RL with a new Accord EXL with a four-cylinder and CVT.
Hell yes.
Partial consideration of your impressions, Zach.
Okay,
so he says, honestly, the CVT wasn't as bad as I thought it might be. He's going to pull the trigger in the next week or two, but he heard you can get an appreciably better deals at the end of summer. He says he can get it right now for $27,000 out the door at 1.9%. Do you think prices will drop enough, if at all, to where it's worth waiting?
I'm gonna field this to you there, brother, since you just bought a car. And I don't buy new cars, so...
EXL is, that's pretty up there in terms of trim level. Mm-hmm. That's not bad, but I think what you need to do is let it play out. You need to be patient. And 1.9% is actually pretty good in terms of financing. I kind of
just want to see if he follows your advice again after after the first.
He actually asks here. He goes, "Am I playing with fire by asking the podcast crew for advice that could very well affect my financial well-being for the second time?"
I will say you're doing right by the Accord with the CVT. That's totally fine. The four cylinder. That's a great driveline.
You'll be
totally
fine with that. It's a decent car.
And that's a very nice car.
Yeah.
When you choose to buy it, that's your cup of tea. Although I will say Memorial Day is coming up, and people love to run sales on Memorial Day.
Yeah.
Meditate on that.
That's true. You can get good deals if you go in for the sale. I think you want to line up your financing. Don't necessarily go with the dealership financing.
Right. That's good. Good tip.
Want to go in armed with financing, so that you know that they're not screwing you. You can be like, nope, here we go. The thing you should negotiate is not the price of the car. You should negotiate the out the door price, which just sounds like you've done, because it's $27,000 out the door versus like, I want the car for $27,000, and then they tack on like $5,000 extra in terms of other things, fees and whatnot. I think if you go in and you express interest and let it play, like go in early in the month and let it wait and stew, and the guy's going to get to the end of the month and he's going to be looking for his bonus and his volume performance, whatever, not necessarily how much profit he brought in. It's how many cars he sold. So you can, if you're patient and wait and let it play out a little bit, they'll come back to you with a decent price. It's not like they're not making any more of them either. So if sure. I give you completely terrible advice and you're like, you know what, that Danroth guy, he sucks, I'm going to go buy one now, you'll probably be able to get a good deal. So that's all fair. I have to say, Tom. Don't change the oil in it unless you really have, you know, have checked it quite well.
I do feel bad. I mean, that
sucks.
That does suck.
I can specifically remember, so the Legend that was my first, like, actual car that I drove around and maintained had the canister oil filter. So there were these three little nuts that you had to take off the studs, and then the cap came down, and all the oil went everywhere, and there was an O-ring that fit down inside the cap, right? You pull the paper filter canister out, put the new one in, stick everything back together. Well, I did that once, and the little O-ring got pinched between the cap and the housing.
Yeah, and there's pressurized oil that goes
right
in there.
So start the car, and there's oil just shooting everywhere. It was huge, huge blow to morale. This was not good.
Exactly.
So I then had to drain it all, you know, out of the filter thing again, and then had to find new oil, and then had to find another O-ring because they only sell the O-rings with the filters, and my car is, of course, sitting there inoperable. It was sweet. It was awesome. So don't feel bad. Happens to the best of us.
It happens to everybody. I mean, I once did wheel bearings, and I learned how to torque a wheel bearing by not torquing wheel bearings properly, and I drove like a couple hundred miles on it that way.
There's a vibration in
the
front.
No, it wasn't a vibration. It was like the brakes would go soft because when you torque a cone bearing.
So your rotor was flopping around in your caliper and pushing your.
It
was
sort of because I torqued it to like the 35 foot pounds or whatever, which is not that much torque. But what you're supposed to do with a wheel bearing when you torque it, you tighten it all the way down, back it off, and then retorque. To the value because you need to seat the bearing. Well, I didn't do that. I just torqued it up and I was like, oh, there it is. And I put the pin in and away I went a couple hundred miles. And I'm like, ah, the brakes feel really soft on the highway. And yeah, the calipers are getting knocked back because they're just like flopping around up there. It's pretty excellent. So, I mean, people make mistakes. That's how you learn. Like,
yep.
You will not make that oil change mistake again. So I don't know. I think that we have wound up another Autobug podcast, unless you have other things you'd like to add.
Nope.
No.
I did see something weird in the car this morning, actually. Thinking about this. Dude behind me, first of all, he pulled very aggressively into the gap that the driver who had been behind me was leaving. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I see this guy in an Accord just like right in there.
Yes.
And then I look back again. And he's not wearing a shirt. He has pulled his shirt off over his head on the highway, mind you. And he's got very hairy arms, which sure. It's like, wow, that is a hairy man. Should do some manscaping. And then he proceeds to turn around in the back seat, grab a polo shirt, pull it on over his head, and then like do his hair in the mirror. And I'm like, dude, you're going down Route 128, which is 95 around Boston. And it can clip along in the morning, but even more dangerously, it clips along and then comes to a screeching halt.
Nice.
Yeah. Mm. That's what I saw in traffic.
Classy.
You guys
sweet.
Are
sweet.
You don't commute. I just thought I'd share. That's all.
I commute sometimes.
I do not commute.
I'm sure though, when you do drive, Zach, you see weird things.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Recently I saw a Dodge Dakota that had been entirely rolled. And the guy was still driving along. The whole cab was like stuck at like a, I don't know, like a 15, 20 degree angle of the side. It was awesome.
It's a parallel.
There was one day driving to my office, which is a 15-mile drive. I passed two Acura ZDXs at once.
No, you did not.
Did you get sucked into a black hole?
Two of them, and they weren't press cars.
It's amazing.
Just two. Maybe they were friends. Maybe it was like two people who sit in like
a club.
Cubes.
Right.
Like, how can we set fire to $45,000?
As quickly as possible.
All right. Well, the Autoblog podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of all-season and high-performance tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. No matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. And you can hit us up at podcast@autoblog.com. We've gotten a bunch of entertaining emails over the last few weeks, and you can leave us a review at itunes.com or just iTunes or whatever. I don't know what the address is actually. You go into iTunes and you can leave a review. You can also, we are on Twitter at Autoblog Podcast or at Z_Bowman or at Boston_Auto, or you are just Stephen Ewing.
I am.
Yeah. You're lucky you have a fairly distinctive name, or you were just early.
I was early.
Yeah, and you were just early. So that's it for this week. We will catch up with you next week. Thanks for listening.
See you guys.
Later.